Okay, we are now on the record for King versus Desert Palace, Inc., case number 71317. When you come forward to the podium, please introduce yourself and your co-counsel, or if there's parties here. And with that, we'll start argument. Would you like to save any time for rebuttal?
Yes, 3 minutes, please.
Sure.
Thank you.
All right, you can proceed whenever you're ready.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court. My name is Corey Kaplan, bar number 13164, and I represent the appellant, Ms. Bernadine King. Also present with me is Dominic Gentile. I'd like to begin with a quote from the decision and order in this case. Although a dispute regarding the authority granted may still remain between Ms. King and Mr. McCosker, that issue remains irrelevant to the enforcement of the settlement agreement heard before the Court. That, Your Honors, is clearly erroneous. Is clearly erroneous because the record demonstrates that Mr. McCosker did not have apparent or actual authority. The Court recognizes this issue of authority is still in question, yet determined that there was authority. Nevada Rule of Civil Procedure 52A states, in pertinent part, findings of fact shall not be set aside unless clearly erroneous, and due regard shall be given to the opportunity of the trial court to judge the credibility of the witnesses. It should be noted here that the judge who wrote this decision and order, the Honorable Kathy Hardcastle, was not the judge who conducted the evidentiary hearing in this case. That was the Honorable Linda Bell. Therefore, Judge Hardcastle had no opportunity to perceive the affect of the witnesses and to determine their credibility. I'm going to begin with apparent authority, and I'd like to start off under the Garner case with the notion that Nevada does not treat the attorney-client relationship like it does other agency-principal relationships. It is held to a higher scrutiny. Apparent authority is that authority which...
Just to clarify one point you just made, you said Judge Hardcastle wrote the order. Did she actually make the findings herself? Did she read a transcript, or did she just sign an order that Judge Bell had prepared?
That is unclear. Her name is on the signature line. And her signature.
Did she have the benefit of a transcript?
She did have I assume she had the benefit of the transcript.
Was this in between when Judge Bell got hit by a car and was out? Because, you know, she was out for a long period of time, Judge Bell.
She was out. I don't remember if that was,
okay.
That was it. But she was present for the evidentiary hearing, and she was not the one who signed the decision.
I mean, as long as a judge reads a transcript, poor Judge Guy died in the middle, 3 weeks into the middle of a jury trial. And literally, Judge Mosley had to read the transcripts to catch up, but ultimately was able to finish it. So are you saying that there's error because Kathy Hardcastle signed this, that no judge can come in? What if somebody died?
I'm not saying that's improper for her to sign it, but the deference awarded in Rule 52A gives deference to the opportunity of the trial court judge to determine the credibility of witnesses. That was not able to be done here.
She simply made a legal ruling, which you've characterized as clearly erroneous, and she didn't make factual findings on credibility.
Correct. Apparent authority is the authority which a principal holds her agent out as possessing or permits him to exercise, or the agent represents himself as possessing. In order to create apparent authority, there has to be more than just the actions of the agent. And the mere retention of an attorney does not convey that authority.
But what about the email from your client, Bernadine, saying that, not that it will change anything, but I'd like to know what he said before I sign. So she even sends an email saying, not that it will change anything. What do you have to say about that?
I believe that email is ambiguous. If you read that in totality, the email prior, originally there was an email on January 20th, sending those settlement documents. She did not respond. On January 27th, there was an email from the paralegal again asking her to sign these documents. She's still trying to persuade her to sign it. If you read that email to which Bernadine responds, she's talking about the $75,000 in her pocket. Let me know if you have any questions. Bernadine's response to that was she has testified that she did not print those documents out. She could not read them. Until her son was able to come home and fix her printer. But she even says, not that it will change anything, but she would like to know what is said. She's not agreeing to sign. She wants to know what, and her testimony was that she didn't even know that they were settlement documents. Well, she knew that they were settlement documents. She didn't know that the case was settled. As an attorney, in an attorney-client relationship, a lot of documents are sent to a client throughout the course of litigation, whether it be verified interrogatories or a HIPAA release. She thought she saw settlement documents on the subject line. And with apparent authority, there needed to be some manifestation from Bernadine to the third party. In this case, it was Mr. Orm, which in the typical instance is a signed settlement and release. To this day, the release was never signed and neither was the settlement agreement. The check was never exchanged for that. If Mr. Orm actually believed that there was a deal, the check could have been delivered before the signed settlement.
How did the settlement change from $140,000 to $145,000?
That was on the representations of Ms. King's son, Zachary King.
So he just came up with a settlement amount and didn't come from his mother?
It did not come from his mother. He represented that his mother did want the $145,000. Well, the record reflects that he contacted Mr. McCosker, who was Bernadine's prior attorney, and said she'll take the $140,000 reluctantly, but would appreciate $145,000. Mr. McCosker then contacted Mr. Orm. Mr. Orm contacted his client, and then back to only Zachary King, never back to Bernadine. And when
does apparent authority apply in that situation, from the plaintiff's attorney to the son, believing the son had the authority to represent what his mother wanted?
But it wasn't reasonable. And in looking at the authority, you look at the totality of circumstances and whether the act was reasonable. And when he was asked, Mr. McCosker was asked during his deposition and at the evidentiary hearing, if Ms. King ever conveyed authority to her son to settle the case, he said no. When asked if she ever conveyed authority to him to authorize the settlement, he said no. The email that authorized Mr. King, Zachary, to participate in this case was at the beginning of settlement discussions, I believe it was December 3rd, where she sent an email, Bernadine sent an email to Mr. McCosker, Zachary, and Ms. Billie Marie Morrison, who was another attorney at the Kenny Law Firm, and it said, I authorize you to call my son Zachary to discuss this matter, or to discuss settlement, I believe. Gave his cell phone number and said he will conference me in. This representation, this communication between Zachary and Mr. McCosker was not about settlement discussions. It was about a binding contract. Second, it was the only communication ever that Bernadine wasn't involved in. And he accepted it on her behalf. And even Mr. McCosker, when responding to Zachary, did not copy Bernadine on that email to confirm the $145,000.
So she really wants to go to trial now?
She always did. There was also no detriment to the respondent. As I mentioned, the check was never cashed. It was never exchanged. The district court confuses this standard and focuses on the inverse. Where it quoted in its decision in order testimony from Mr. Orm regarding whether he ever received communication from Ms. King that he was not authorized to negotiate a settlement. That is the inverse standard. And I quote, question, did you ever receive communication from her, meaning Bernadine, whether it be email, phone call, a mailing that told you that they, meaning the Kenny firm, were not authorized to negotiate a settlement on her behalf? Answer, no. First, the issue is not negotiating a settlement, as I mentioned. It's accepting the settlement. He was clearly permitted in his duties as an attorney to negotiate a settlement without her authority. But entering into a binding agreement is a completely distinct action. Second, case law states that in order to justifiably rely on apparent authority, the third party needs to obtain a manifestation from the principal that the agent can act on her behalf. As he testified, he never received any communication from Ms. King other than deposing her. The manifestation would be the signed settlement and release. Even further, Mr. McCosker testified at the evidentiary hearing that when he got the phone call from Zachary, he called Mr. Orm and said, I told Chris, I said, look, I got the call from Zach. She accepts it. Zach is not the client. Zach is not a she. There was no reasonable reliance there, and especially when Mr. Orem testified that the only basis for his belief was Mr. McCosker's acts alone, which can't be relied upon to support an estoppel. Well,
Mr. Kaplan, what about the attorney lien? That was also adjudicated by the district court. That's not being challenged on appeal, and yet the Kenny law firm is getting the $60,000-plus, even though the case is not settled now?
Even though the case is not settled. They did do work in obtaining that, and that is pursuant to their retainer.
So that has no bearing here.
That has no bearing.
You're going to need it for what you're telling us, right? They'll need it later. Is that what you're saying?
I did not say that. moving on to actual authority. There are two types, actual express and actual implied. The district court relied in its decision and order on this broad power of attorney language in the retainer agreement with the Kenny Law Firm that states that the law firm was granted a broad power of attorney with respect to pleadings, claims, contracts, settlement checks, etc., in every aspect as if the client were doing so. Both Mr. McCosker and Bernadine, the two parties to that retainer agreement, acknowledged that this broad language did not grant Mr. McCosker the authority to settle the case without her.
That's no longer an issue then. That's essentially a stipulation.
Respondent conceded that in their answering brief.
So the district court's basis for its ruling then is faulty, flawed, and shouldn't be binding.
Flawed on multiple levels. So not just on the express authority, but also in the implied and the apparent. moving on to the actual implied authority, which is the last basis for authority. The factual inquiry is the same as apparent authority, except that the principal's manifestations to the agent are substituted in place of those of the third parties. Here, it would come about when an agent reasonably believes he possesses authority due to the result of representations of the principal or acts permitted by the principal over the course of time. The dispute here comes from this communication from Zachary to McCosker. Zachary was involved, I believe Mr. McCosker testified, four or five times, involved with Bernadine on settlement discussions. She was merely waiving the attorney-client privilege to her attorney to include her son on settlement discussions. That was not to authorize him to enter into a binding agreement on her behalf and waive her substantive rights as a client in a civil case.
And didn't Mr. McCosker, he testified at the hearing that he did not have her authority.
Correct. And he knew he still needed it, which is why he sent the settlement document. If he really believed that he had authority or that her son had authority, why were they pushing her to sign the settlement documents? Because she's the client and she never relinquished that authority. As I mentioned before, every time Zachary communicated, up until this final communication where this alleged acceptance took place, Bernadine had been involved. The course of conduct simply involved Zachary in settlement discussions, not authority to bind his mother.
You want to stop here because you got about 2 minutes and 11 seconds.
Sure. Thank you.
We'll hear from respondent.
Thank you, Your Honor. Michael Wall, on behalf of the respondents, Desert Palace. I have with me Christian Warham, who was also an attorney in our office and was the attorney who was involved in this through the settlement part. He wanted me to tell the court that he wants to make sure there is nothing that comes out of this case that can be referred to as the Orem Rule.
Well, let me ask you this, then, going to the Orem Rule.
No. When I...
That's good. Now let me write that down, the Orem Rule. When you look at this case, I mean, taken to its logical end then, the district court writes on page 4 of its order, in the discussion, it writes a lot about the attorney agreement, the retainer, and it seems to base its decision on that. I mean, if we take this to its logical end and we make the Orem Rule, then any adhesion... Sorry about that. Now I'm just going to keep rolling with it. But any adhesion type of retainer, any adhesion type of boilerplate contract that a plaintiff attorney, I mean, imagine all the plaintiff attorney firms out there, they can then, taken to its logical end, just because of a retainer agreement, they can settle it without consent of the client? Because at the evidentiary hearing, the attorney admitted he didn't have the consent of the client.
He did not admit that, number one. I would like to address that.
Okay.
He didn't admit that he didn't have the consent of the client. That's wrong. But going back to that exact thing, the judge put a number of things into her decision. By the way, it's on Judge Bell's letterhead. It was simply signed by Judge Hardcastle. We don't know exactly how that came about, but we know when it came about, and it was during that time. The point of the matter is the judge gave a number of reasons why she made her suggestion, and appellate courts look to find the reasons that support the decision, not those that do not. The judge was wrong on that one thing, and if the
you concede that.
I conceded that in the brief. If the case turned on that point alone, the judge was wrong. There's certainly no authority from the retainer agreement itself for the settlement to be entered into by the attorney over and against the will of the client. Number two, though, is this conception that McCosker admitted that he did not have authority of his client. If you go and read that transcript, you will see he thought and believed he had authority, actual authority, from his client. What he admitted was that he didn't talk to her on that morning. He talked to Zach. Zach called her on that morning where they were supposed to have a call, a conference call at 9 o'clock, and said, we don't need to have that conference call. My mother agrees to the settlement agreement. However, if you could get her an extra five, that would be great. My mother agrees. There are two agency relationships at issue in this case. There's an important one, and it's between Zach and Ms. King, Bernadine. That relationship, they say, we'll reconstrue all of the things that were said after the fact, but that's not what the standard is. The standard is, did the person who was relying on this agency relationship act reasonably based on the conduct of the principal over a period of time? Zach was involved from the beginning. He was involved in every settlement discussion. He was involved in every discussion that they had. They were going to discuss it, and Zach calls at shortly before 9 o'clock and says, we don't need to have a telephone conference at 9 o'clock. My mother wants to accept and has given me authority to accept. McCosker construed that as being actual authority through Zach to do what he did. And that's what the law requires.
But did the judge make a finding to that effect?
The judge did make a finding.
That would be a factual finding that McCosker acted reasonably in relying upon what Zach said, and that meant that Zach had the authority because the mother said it.
The judge did. The judge went through and found all of the facts that are consistent with that finding. And even if the judge didn't express that finding as well as the judge could have done, appellate courts will uphold the decision of a lower court, even when it's based slightly on the wrong reason, if the record supports the decision that was made, and here it does.
Why have District Court Rule 13, and why have the Grisham case, where we talk about material terms are agreed upon by the party? Here, you don't even have the party agreeing to any terms.
The party agreed to all of the terms through Zach. Absolutely and directly did so. And we know she did so because of two things. Number one, when 9 o'clock came around, she didn't call up and say, time for our conference. She knew what Zach had done already. She didn't call up later and say, time for, hey, let's discuss this settlement. And then here we have the misrepresentation that was made multiple times during the other argument. The days that went by after the fact, she receives three emails. Her excuse is, I couldn't print those documents out. I didn't know what the settlement agreement was. Well, go read the emails. The terms of the settlement are in the email themselves. She didn't have to print it out. One of those emails says to her, good news. We have been able to arrange all of the things, and we're going to be able to put $76,000 in your pocket. She didn't pick up the phone and say, what are you talking about? You're going to put $76,000 in my pocket. I haven't agreed to any settlement here. She knew they were settlement documents. She got those settlement documents immediately after the settlement was entered into. She never went to McCosker and said, I don't have a settlement. She had email which explained that to her. She got emails after that, two of them. And in one of them, she responded with, so sorry, I haven't signed and sent the documents back yet. I haven't been able to get them out of the machine. She clearly expressed in that email an intent to sign the documents. She knew there was a settlement. If she thought there was no settlement, she didn't just think, oh, here's a proposal of settlement. She had emails that were saying, why haven't you signed the documents and sent them back? She doesn't contact counsel and say, hey, there's no settlement here, even when she gets the last email, which has all of the terms of the settlement in it. Instead, a week later, counsel gets a call from an attorney in Florida who says, hey, deal or no deal? No deal. We're not going to take it. We think we can get more. That's what's going on here. Bernadine clearly agreed to all of the material terms, actually, and she knew it.
Counsel, let me ask you about reasonableness here. There are some situations that I'm sure you and many other attorneys and I've encountered before I was on the bench where it's reasonable to infer that somebody's son is acting as a go-between. Your client, say, has limited English-speaking abilities. Your client has a low level of education. So they rely on their son to act as sort of an informal interpreter, translator kind of thing. I've had that situation many times in my career. And so anyone looking at that situation would say, look, that's the only way you're going to communicate with your client. Do you want to hire an interpreter, translator every time you want to communicate with your client? No, you go through the son. So in this case, what is it about Bernadine that the lawyer can't talk to her? Why is the son even involved? Does she have some language problem?
She doesn't have anything like that.
Why is the son even here? And why is it reasonable to assume that, just because if I have a perfectly reasonable client who is educated, who I can talk to, why am I talking to anybody but her?
We don't have anything in the record that specifically addresses her having any kind of a disability in any way. She's just a person who relies on her son.
So why would it be reasonable for an attorney looking at that position to think, I could just talk to someone other than my client? I think most people would agree it's reasonable if your client doesn't speak English. But why would it be reasonable in this case?
Because she introduced Zach and had Zach talk to her in every single conversation that they had about settlement. She was basically communicating through Zach, and that's what the record shows. And those inferences are there. And every inference has to be drawn in favor of the decision that was made by the judge who got to watch and see what happened. What is the elephant in this room is that there was an evidentiary hearing on this. They had the burden of proof at that evidentiary hearing, and guess who didn't testify? Zach, who is beyond the subpoena power of the state, so we couldn't have brought him. Why did we not have Zach there saying, yeah, my mom told me to make that telephone call, or not saying
that? Why would they have the burden of proof when your client filed the motion to enforce?
They were the ones that were claiming that there was no settlement when there was a settlement and that there was no agreement. They should have been trying to demonstrate the difference between the agreement between Zach and the mother. And Zach isn't there. So the fact that he's not there is a glaring error in this case.
I agree that that's one of the first things I was looking for. Where's the transcript from Zach? Well, there isn't one. But the burden of proof, that's a whole different issue.
That's true. We had the burden of proof. But here's how that is proven. 10 minutes after she doesn't call, she ratifies it over and over and over again. We know that she authorized Zach to do that. And that inference is there.
We know that, but under NC-DSH versus Gardner, that whole case with Davidson, isn't there like a public policy? Isn't it scary to take something like this and have an attorney, a plaintiff attorney with a defense attorney coming into a settlement agreement without actual consent from the client, writing or otherwise? We're just going to infer. We can make a lot of inferences of what really happened here with or without the son. But we're stuck with the record. And that record is that you have two attorneys entering into this resolution without the client. Isn't there a danger, Justice Pickering said it in that case, of a Larry Davidson all over again?
Not really. Here's the thing. You keep saying without the client, and that's exactly what the record demonstrates. It was with the client. And the district judge heard everybody and said it was with the client.
She testified it wasn't. She testified at the evidentiary hearing that it wasn't.
But the evidence, all the other evidence was the other way, and McCosker testified that it was. And
you're saying we should affirm this based on wrong reason, right result.
No, I think that we should affirm this. Yes, I do think that it's the right
result. Based on the district court order.
I think it's a part of, if you read all of her decision, that overall she saw there was a settlement here, and she put in all of those facts, and she reached different conclusions, and she reached the conclusion that there was apparent authority here and that there was actual authority here can be read into this decision.
I just looked at it again. I don't see that the judge made any findings that the attorney could rely upon what Zach said because Zach had the authority, apparent or otherwise. I mean, she talks around some of it, but she never actually makes a finding on it. If she had, you would have a very, very good argument.
I concede what the order says. I concede the way that it's written and that it goes on and focuses on apparent authority. I believe that there is apparent authority under the circumstances of this case because all of the attorneys, it happens every single day. And this isn't anything like the Garner case.
It does happen every day. That's the thing. It does happen every day.
In Garner, we had an overreaching attorney. In every case they rely on, you have an overreaching attorney. We have an attorney who completely stole the money. We have an attorney who engaged in criminal conduct. We had an attorney whose client said, do not agree to arbitration, and he went and arbitrated without her even there. We have those kinds of circumstances. But we have to look at the reality of the world. If Mr. Orem is called on the phone and Mr. McOsker says, as he does, I have authority from my client to settle this, what is Mr. Orem supposed to do?
What's the detriment? Where's the detriment of Caesar's Palace?
The detriment to Caesar's Palace is that they did not continue to prepare and go to trial. Time has been lost. They gave up their defenses.
They haven't filed the motion to enforce, and I realize that the testimony changed, at least the attorneys, plaintiff's attorneys, kind of like, when they filed the motion to what happened at the evidentiary hearing, it looks like the plaintiff's attorney, his testimony changed.
The detriment.
But you could have withdrawn it, too, and gone to trial. I mean, that is the opposite.
That is the opposite. The detriment is we get to defend it twice. We get to push it to a conclusion and defend it twice after there has been a conclusion and there's an agreement. And there was clearly an agreement here. She simply had cold feet and changed her mind, and then she recharacterizes what happened because she hasn't signed the documents yet. Mr. Orem couldn't call her up on the phone. He couldn't depose her. There's nothing that he could do. There is no standard that you could set that would be what the attorney who is getting the call from the other attorney is supposed to do in order to know whether or not they have a settlement. So we don't have settlements until they're actually signed. If that's going to be the standard, it has never been the standard. And these cases don't go that far. These cases, the language that's taken out of them are to address circumstances where you had an attorney clearly overreaching, and McOsker didn't do that. Everything McOsker did was right, and everything Mr. Orem did was right, and they had a settlement, and they put it in writing, and they gave it to Ms. King in writing. And she didn't say anything for over 3 weeks. And then she gets an attorney in Florida. She has cold feet, and she wants to change her mind.
Mr. Wall, do you remember the case from many years ago now where the insurance company made out the check to the law firm instead of to the client or jointly, and the money never made it to the client, and that caused a change in practice on how these settlements would be paid?
Yes, and that's why we had the Garner case, is that the client was not bound by the decision that was made clearly and in without her authority. We had an evidentiary hearing here.
Maybe it's the same thing here, where now on the defense side, you're going to have to clarify about the client has actually agreed to it. And
I can't imagine how you're going to write a standard that's going to work for that. But Judge Bell got to see the witnesses, and Judge Bell said, there's a settlement here. She may not have done the best job possible writing that decision, but that's the conclusion she reached.
I mean, we all empathize with this. I mean, settlements are certainly desired. I mean, what if you win a trial? Aren't you going to have a great case now for attorney's fees against the other side?
Not really. It's a personal injury case. I think there was a settlement.
Minutes.
Just in brief reference to the conference call that was mentioned, counsel made a point to state that Bernadine never called in at 9 o'clock like it was scheduled and never made any point of why was this conference call scheduled. If you look at the emails in the record, she was not copied on that conference call. Setting that conference call, it was between Zach and Mr. McOsker alone. Zach called in early, the agreement was between those two, and then he came back and McCosker only emailed him. There's no evidence in the record to suggest that Bernstein was even aware of that conference call. Now to the policy aspect of this case. As Your Honor mentioned, this happens every day. We need a bright-line rule. Whether that is to get a signed agreement or to get consent, counsel did not believe they had an agreement. Otherwise, the check would have been released. They would not release that check until they got the signed release and settlement back. They said it. They sat on it. They would not give it up, and that's how it happens every day. And Mr. Orme even testified that he knew something was wrong when he didn't get it, because in typical situations, you get that back and you get the check. There was no detriment to that effect either. And in addition to counsel's representations, they don't have to defend this twice. It wasn't defended the first time. If this decision and order is reversed, as we're requesting, this case will be remanded back to the trial court level to proceed to trial, to be defended one time, which has not yet been done. Thank you.
Thank you. All right. This